This is the Roaring Elephant Podcast, and we're back again with more open source insights brought to you today by Dave.
Open source is good. That's my insight. How's that?
And that was it for today. Have a nice day, everybody. We'll be back next week with more insights from Dave.
God, can you imagine like every podcast being about 60 seconds? Everyone just has a single insight from Dave introduced.
From now on, we're the podcasting.
God. Oh, what a hellscape this would be.
It exists. It's called TikTok.
Imagine TikTok, but audio only.
That's ASMR.
It immediately
starts doing it. Okay, fair enough.
Let's not go to this bit
that we start digging. Let's fill it up again and go to nice, safe, and always welcome open source.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we were talking last episode about some of the reasons why organizations are choosing open source. But one of the things that I would say on this is there is quite a skew of the types of organizations that put cost reduction as their number one reason. And I was going to say, guess which industry segments have the largest vote, but I know that
poor
you also read my notes. No, it's not podcasting people. It is government and public sector at 92% of those folks said that cost reduction was their number one reason. So for other industries, no reduction, no license was significantly less their number one reason. But for government and pub sector, which again, you can't fault them for it. It makes sense. Public sector and government budgets are amongst some of the hardest hit always when there's any kind of reductions. And it makes sense. But
it's a bit of a shift, though.
Sad to hear.
Because when I was working semi-government at Supercomputing Center here, we actually had a mandate from the Minister of Economics or something like that, that we should not buy software licenses, but go to open source when possible, with the intention of creating a knowledgeable workforce. Mm. Idea being that you can go into government, low-paying jobs typically, you can play with open source, you get more smarter, and then you move into the industry in a local country with your open source knowledge to do better things. So that was a decree, actually, and we did that very religiously, to be honest, and it actually worked, because look at me.
Yeah, that's cool. That is very cool.
So I'm hoping that's still in effect. I mean, this is now like 14 years ago, so things have definitely changed. Obviously, there's probably not less of a need to do something like this because open source has now become pervasive pretty much everywhere. In schools, in universities, you learn a lot of open source anyway. Maybe just the funding, budgeting restrictions, they are real. I mean, I work with a lot of public sector customers in my daily job, so I can definitely attest that licensing fees are an quote-unquote easy one to cut. But of course, with everything we talked about last time about being aware of what the consequences are of moving to a zero license, but you maintain this thing now and you have to have the knowledge inside to do this. As long as that's a part of it, that's okay.
Yep, indeed. Indeed. All right. Anything else on the investment or on the sort of reasons why side of things?
No, I mean, the report still calls out the four top ones below the list cost reduction. So reduce vendor lock-in. I think that's a bad reason because vendor lock-in doesn't exist. It's product lock-in. But in the past, vendors owned products and that way became a vendor lock-in. But if you make a choice now for Postgres database, for example, and you base everything in your company on Postgres, and at some point you want to move to something else, you have a lock-in there. Anything that requires effort to move away from, is it a lock-in, and anything significant will require an effort. So open source has a different kind of lock-in perhaps, but you're still tied to the certain, the certain technologies that you invested in, the people that you hired were knowledgeable about Postgres. They're probably not as knowledgeable about CosmoDB, something else. So the vendor lock-in, I think, if that's the reason to do it, you're doing it wrong, if I can say that.
Yeah, and again, this is one of those things where we are, not nitpicking as such, but we are looking at the exact wording that is used here, and we have certain perspectives on what that means to us, what it means to the surveyors, what it means to the respondents, who knows? Like they could be very much looking at it from a different perspective, but it's open to interpretation, which is one of the things I don't like about this. But it is what it is. It's the way it goes.
If you want me to be literal, then I think that's a good reason. Because if you take it literally, vendor lock-in, then open source does actually give you a release from that, which may mean is that if an open source project goes away, almost never happens. If it's not popular and just dies out, that's a good thing. Things should die out then. But popular things, look at MySQL, there were some issues there, it got forked to MariaDB. OpenOffice, LibreOffice. So from that point of view, you're no longer attached to the governing body behind the software in open source, because if it's commercial and company goes bust, software goes away. It's IP license patented, nobody can use it anymore. With open source, you won't get that. From that point of view, yes, you don't have a vendor lock-in, but I don't think that's what they meant.
Indeed. But who knows? Who knows? It's difficult to understand. But maybe moving on a little bit then. So
I want to talk about open standards and stuff. Okay, fair enough.
We're going to get there. But first of all, we're going to talk. So we've talked a lot about people are deploying more open source. What is it that they're actually deploying more of? This has been kind of back and forth a little bit, especially as we kind of go back into the 2023, 2024, and now 2025. But in 2025, we'll start with the most current data. Number one, by a reasonably significant margin, is cloud and container technologies at basically 40%. Not terribly surprising. And again, like there's a bit of a connection to a later stat, but I'll hold on to that for now. With like databases and data technologies being like 33%. And then programming languages and frameworks being basically 33% as well. None of those things particularly surprise me. Looking back at the data, SDLC sort of tooling was number one back in 2023 with containers and container and sort of orchestration technology being bundled into together, which have been split out, and that was number two, with databases and data technologies being number three. And then in 2024, it was databases and data technologies number one, cloud and containers very close number two, and programming languages and frameworks number three. So yeah, it feels very much of the time that cloud and container technologies right now would be the most prevalent thing. I don't know if you sort of think that this has changed in any kind of real meaningful or interesting way.
I think it comes back to what I talked about previously about open source CapEx, people going to cloud because they think it can solve all their problems, and personally not too big of a fan. The software, what's it called again? Lifecycle tools dropping off the map kind of makes sense, I guess. But programming languages came from pretty far back, 70% in 2022, to third place in 2024, and now third place again in 2025. So I was kind of taken aback at that one at first glance. I mean, program language and frameworks, all of those are open source, aren't they? Oh, God, I forgot a couple of things there.
but remember, this is not what people are using. This is what people are investing in. So the way that I look at it is in 2023, SDLC tooling was like right at the top because people, exactly as you said, I think last episode, were like really getting into this very, very heavily. And they needed to put a lot of investment in the tooling. Fast forward a year to 2024, like they got that stuff in and they were investing a lot more in databases and data technologies and the cloud and container technologies and programming frameworks were also kind of number three there. Mm-hmm. And then like fast forward to today, now it's flipped a little bit. And like the, if you said, as you said, like SDLC tooling is down at like 9%, whereas you know, the other top things are up in the 30s, even 40s. But that to me just says, like, we've got our SDLC tooling, our CI/CD pipelines, we've got all of that stuff established. Like, it just works. We tweak it here and there. We don't need to heavily invest in it anymore, but we are still investing heavily in cloud and container technologies. And that's the one thing that I want to highlight on this is, it, don't forget that they've bundled together cloud and container technologies. So not everyone that said yes to this is what we're most investing in is on cloud, but they are using container technologies. And I think, again, this is one of those things where depending on how you design your survey, you can kind of skew the perception of certain things.
I really wish I had separated those two from each other. I'd be very curious to see, or make it like an on-prem versus non-on-prem or something like that.
We will, spoiler alert, we will see a little bit later where I think some of this gets shown. But anyway, let's
really, I think.
We'll continue this for now.
Anything else? I mean, it's the separation has gone larger. It's more focused this year. Last year was kind of a nice, flowy, slow-growing
gradient.
Now it's really cloud and containers at 40%. Then you have two at 30-ish% being database and programming language. Then you drop back to 20% for dev, GitOps, operating systems, things like that. So people are getting more focused. But this could, again, be bias on the survey.
Yep, indeed. Indeed. All right. Well, I think the next big thing is around kind of open source support and sort of the challenges around it and maintenance and that side of things. And this is one of those areas that I'm not so sure. It's not necessarily in contradiction to what we talked about in the first episode around cost reductions / no license. But if you look at this, they talk about if you're using some sort of proprietary, either proprietary version of open source software or proprietary software, what's the number one thing keeping you from switching to open source technology? Again, I really don't like this question at all in the first place.
It's badly formulated.
Because it sort of, it blends lots of things together. But professional support and maintenance, by far in a way, is the number one kind of reason. It's not the features that they're missing. That is the second most reason, but that's down at 24%. And professional support and maintenance is up at 45%, basically. So, you know, this to me is just one of those things that highlights why so many organizations have a commercial relationship. And again, this is brought out later on in the survey. We'll get to that. But this to me highlights why so many organizations still want a commercial relationship with an organization that is behind an open source project in a lot of cases.
I mean, support and features. I mean, if you look at open source, that gets commercialized by a backing company that then asks money for it. What do those backing companies offer? Support and sometimes additional feature and customization. So if you then ask people, why are you paying a license? It's going to be obvious that that's, those are going to be the biggest two, because that's basically what you can buy with your money in open source. And a lot of open source companies only offer support. So that makes total sense. That's the biggest one here in the graph. And then a part of open source companies also offer support and additional features behind the paywall, if I call it that. So this graph, I mean, yeah, obviously, I don't see any reason why the graph would be any different. The one thing that I'm a bit surprised about is having legal protection so low, because a lot of companies also want kind of the indemnification. However, I think in the last years, maybe decade, indemnification isn't being offered that much anymore, because it's pretty much an insurance nightmare.
That's a good question. I honestly don't know enough to answer that question. It's one of those things that I haven't really seen tested very much over the years. I think there have been a handful of cases where it's come up, but it's, I think as open source has become more prevalent, people have become less concerned about that being a thing. I don't know. Maybe I
think
it's not something that I think
that non-open source software has proven to be so buggy that they don't really make a difference anymore for open source. But I mean, when I started at Hortonworks 10 years ago, every other customer kind of came back with this, what's your notification clause if you pay for a support contract? Because that's what we're used to from an IBM and a Red Hat, sorry, an IBM and a Oracle kind of establishment. These days, it never comes up anymore, which again is a good thing, because you should do your due diligence and make a good choice and have use your brain in selecting a vendor, just like with open source or non-open source. And again, the myth that closed source is safer, less buggy, whatever. Well, we'd had a little bit of SharePoint issues last month and so. So, did I say that? No, I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, the next sort of one on this, which I think flows really nicely, is the fact that a lot of organizations, and this absolutely zero surprise here, are working with commercial vendors to help them support their open source packages in their stack. You know, the 45% of organizations are working with somewhere between 1 and 5 vendors, which is, you know, great.
Sweet spot, I'd say.
I think it works out to be, let's see, about 60-65% of organizations basically have some sort of vendor relationship, and about just over 30% of organizations have no commercial relationship with a vendor for support of their open source packages, which to me this makes perfect sense. And again, think about the audience that we're surveying here. Mm-hmm. It is primarily engineers with a side flavor of sysadmins, and then a whole bunch of other people down the line in far, far smaller groups. So bear that bias in mind. There'll be a lot of programming languages, there'll be a lot of libraries, there'll be a lot of things like that. A lot of engineers using Docker on their laptops or on their workstations, things like that. So there is bias in this data, but I think that's fine as long as you acknowledge it.
Yeah, I do think that none is a bunch of liars. Less informed people, because every company that does development has a Jira, and you can bet your house that Jira is going to have a contract somewhere. Because if that thing goes down, they have a problem. If you look if they're using GitHub, you can pretty damn sure that they're paying for the GitHub, because it's inherently. So I think it's also just people not realizing sometimes that somebody somewhere is actually paying for this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. All right. Any last words on this? Because I think we are pretty much at time.
Yes, we've filled our allotment of open source babble again for this week. So I'm handing it back to Dave to take it away.
Indeed. Indeed. So this is all the time we have for today. You can support this podcast by becoming a Patreon. Every contribution really does help. You can also go to roaringelephant.org for a link to our Patreon page and more information about the podcast. And please send any feedback to podcast@roaringelephant.org. Until next time, my name is... I fully endorse you having a vendor relationship for your open source, Dave.
And my name is, if I can't open a support contract on my life, does that mean I'm open source? Yo.
Very philosophical question there. And we look forward to talking to you next week.
Goodbye.
See you there.